Good morning. Today is Monday, December 30th, 2024. I'm your host, Kevin Kennedy. Roger is off. Well, he told me he was on grandparent duty, but he just gave me a call. He's at the Park City base, and he says some of the lifts are starting to move. So maybe he's skiing with his grandkids. Anyways, good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Today we have excerpts from three author interviews from this year whose books made the New York Times 100 Notable Books of 2024. Stand by, we'll be right back.
Phil Elwood is a public relations professional. Now, most Americans don't really know what that job entails, but Phil Elwood has quite a few tales that explain it, and he does so in his new book, All the Worst People, How I Made News for Dictators, Tycoons, and Politicians. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, and it's actually All the Worst Humans.
Oh, I read it wrong. All right, so the book is quite a tell-all. What motivated you to write it?
Well, actually, I was talked into it. None of this was my idea. I was out to a breakfast one morning with two investigative journalists there in Washington, D.C., and they told me that they were writing a book about scumbags in D.C., and they wanted me to be a character, to which I promptly responded, you need to work on your pitch because absolutely no one is going to agree to this. And, you know, after telling them no, they said, Phil, you know, your story, it's far too interesting. It's going to get out there sometime, so you should probably get in front of it. Take your advice as a crisis communications professional. Get in front of the story and tell it yourself. So they introduced me to a literary agent, and the rest is kind of history.
How did you begin your career, and what led you to PR specifically?
Well, the beginning of my career, see, this is a very interesting story. I started out as on a debate scholarship at the University of Pittsburgh. I had to drop out of the University of Pittsburgh due to developing a bit of a drug problem. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. to dry out. I ended up, through a friend, working as an intern for the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee at the time. While I was working for him, I was admitted to George Washington University as a transfer student. Shortly before I enrolled, I was arrested for falling drunkenly through a window of Gelman Library at GW, and had no place to go to school and no job because Moynihan was retiring. So his staff leaned on the staff of the senator across the hall, a man named Senator Carl Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And they got him to hire me as a legislative correspondent. I worked there for about a year, and the chief of staff hauled me into his office and said, Phil, this is kind of embarrassing. You need to go get a college degree. And at which point they wrote a letter of recommendation that got me into Georgetown University. And I graduated from there and then got some help getting into the London School of Economics for graduate school. So that completes my academic career. I then moved back to Washington, D.C. and applied at all kinds of different firms, lobbying firms, PR firms, think tanks, and finally got offered a job at pretty much the smallest PR firm in D.C. and went to work doing the business of public relations. I had to teach myself how to do it.
We're going to talk a lot about that business and what it means, but let's start by talking about, you know, the book is filled with great stories, but I want to start with the Gunner Palace story, and I want you to explain to the audience what it means to sink a body.
All right. Well, it's helpful to tell a brief story from my childhood. My father was a pastor when I was growing up, and so my job in middle school was to be the altar boy for him at funerals, meaning to hold the cross and look sad. One day we were doing a funeral, and something happened, and the water started leaking into the hole, and the coffin started submerging or coming up from the ground, and I had to put my foot on it to make it so that the audience didn't see that we were hiding the fact that a coffin was coming out of the ground in the middle of a funeral. My father then left and asked me to handle it, and I jumped on the coffin to submerge it into the water and fell into the grave. Now, what this has to do with public relations is that sometimes in public relations, when the wheels fall off the wagon, you need to distract the audience from what's really going on and, metaphorically speaking, sink the body. Now, my first public relations engagement ever was to was on a documentary film called Gunner Palace. And this was a film about the United States' second occupation of Iraq following the events of 9/11. And the documentary received an R rating because a certain word that begins with F appears in the film over, I think it's 40 or 50 times. And the Motion Picture Association of America says that if that word appears in a film more than once, it gets an automatic R rating. Now, our concern was that school children ages 14 to 16 wouldn't be able to go see an R-rated film. And those were that was our key audience. Those were the kids who were thinking about enlisting to go and fight in Iraq. And we thought they should see what it's really like before they did that. So we went on a campaign. I put the director and a soldier from the film on all three major cable news networks and introduced them to a number of reporters who wrote stories in support of Gunner Palace. And as a result, Gunner Palace has a PG-13 rating to this day, and it is one of the most profane PG-13 rating movies in history.
I assume Peter Brown caught wind of who you are at that time. Can you share a bit about Brown and what it was like to work for him?
Peter Brown gave me a whole new life. It actually wasn't just after my work for Gunner Palace. It was after my work for a firm called Burson Marsteller that I got the attention of Peter. And he hired me and really introduced me to an entirely new world. Two lines that stick with me that he said on a fairly regular basis were, everyone deserves representation and anything is possible with the right amount of money. He knew this well because he was the former he was the former PR man for the Beatles. He got his start working at a record store in Liverpool, and when the Beatles started touring and becoming a big name, they needed a PR guy, so they hired Peter. He then worked with them for a number of years. After their manager died, he assumed several of the management responsibilities. He was on the board of Apple Corp, Apple, the record label that the Beatles started. And so he was well known throughout the media circles, throughout the world, and the firm. Another exotic client list, one that I was not made privy to before I signed up to work for them. And on my first day at the firm, I was passed a form. And at the top of the form, it said the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938. And I needed to sign this form that said that I would be working for a Libyan and that I would be working to advance the interests of Libya. And it turned out, I didn't really put two and two together at the time, but it turned out that meant my client was the family of Muammar Gaddafi. Oh, I was just going to say a number of interesting stories happened during my tenure working for Muammar Gaddafi and his family, including when they released the Lockerbie bomber and a few other very interesting stories I'm sure we can get into if you'd like.
Oh, I think you should talk a little bit about your trip to Las Vegas and then how you tried to manage the Lockerbie bombing publicity problem.
Sure, sure. So it was one afternoon. I was in my apartment and I received a call from my manager. And he told me, you know, Phil, we need you to pack a bag. Need you to get on a plane to Vegas. It'll be good. And they didn't tell me why I was going, so I kind of assumed I was going for a conference or a trade show or something normal like that. And I remember I was sitting in on the plane, and they had just closed the aircraft door, and an email bleeped through on my BlackBerry. That's what I was carrying at the time, on one of those hockey puck situations. And it bleeped through on my BlackBerry, and the subject line was Leaving Las Vegas, a notorious film where Nicolas Cage drinks himself to death. And the substance of this email is about four pages, if you were to print it off, talked about Well, it was a list of demands from one of Muammar Gaddafi's sons, Muqtasim Gaddafi. He was the 35-year-old national security advisor for Libya, who had his own personal military unit in Tripoli. And he was partying in Vegas for a weekend. And because his father, the following week, was going to be speaking at the United Nations General Assembly in that crazy rambling speech that many of your listeners will probably remember. But my job was to babysit Muqtasim, who I was to refer to as the doctor for strange reasons. While he partied with his entourage in Vegas. Now, some of the demands on this list were rather strange. They wanted to buy an Escalade. They wanted to buy some Harleys, have them shipped over to Libya. He wanted to see Cher perform and also wanted to buy some jean shorts. While we were there, he spent my annual income at a single spin of the roulette wheel one evening, and then proceeded to gamble for the rest of the night. Once he ran out of chips, and I had to run up to the head of security's room, and they told me to get some money. And I said, well, how much money do you want me to get? And they said, just get us a bag full. So we were measuring money in bags at that point. And so I went up to the room, and not kidding you, there was a black snakeskin leather briefcase that I popped open, and it was full of money, just filled to the brim with cash. And so I just took the garbage bag out of the trash can in the hotel and filled it with money, and then walked down to the roulette table where he was throwing away his country's money. And passed that to him. He had it changed for chips, and that continued on. Some of the other interesting aspects of the Vegas story were arranging for private planes for some members of the entourage to fly them to and back from L.A. It was one of the strangest experiences of my life, I have to say, and I'm really happy that I made it out alive.
Did you and your firm have to pick up the tab at the hotel?
Yeah, one of the main goals was to have me pay for everything. So because you don't really want to go to, you know, a gentleman's club or someplace like that, throw down a credit card that says Gaddafi on it. I mean, that wouldn't be good. Mostly considering, because this was the last week of Ramadan, one of the holiest times in the Muslim faith, and we were celebrating by partying in Vegas. So it was definitely a different experience, and one that I'm very happy that I lived through. You ask about the Lockerbie bomber case as well, and this one is pretty horrible because it was before the events of Vegas, and I was just getting to know the client, and I got summoned to the Libyan embassy in Washington, D.C., and it was at the Watergate Hotel at the time, you know. So I was thinking to myself, well, nothing shady's ever happened here, so I'm sure it'll be fine. So I go to the Watergate, and I meet with the ambassador, and I'm sitting there in his office, and he says, Phil, a Libyan national hero is going to be released in 48 hours, and we need you to help us gauge what the global media's response to this is going to be. And I don't know much about Libyan national heroes at the time, so I asked who it was. And he said the gentleman's name was Al-Megrahi, a name that I was familiar with because I was alive in 1988 when he blew up Pan Am Flight 103, killing over 270 people, many of them Americans, men, women, and children, indiscriminately. And I was instructed to get a positive piece of press for the Gaddafis, the week Al-Megrahi was released, seemingly an impossible task. I then did a little research and found that a member of Congress that I had a relationship with, a friendship with, or his staff at least, had been responsible for opening the door with Libya. So I communicated with this office, and he was the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee at the time. I communicated with this office that if we didn't do something, Libya was going to suspend diplomatic relations with the United States. They were going to cease to be a partner in the war on terror, meaning killing al-Qaeda in Africa for us, and that this would be bad geopolitically. So the member of Congress agreed to sign a letter that I had written, that the message of the letter and a direct quote from it was knock off the Libya bashing. After he signed the letter and sent it back to me, I leaked it to a reporter at Politico, who then wrote a story with the headline, knock off the Libya bashing. And that's how I got a positive piece of press for the Gaddafis the week al-Megrahi was released.
So, you know, this book takes you through a number of jobs. We sort of near the end, you've left a number of jobs. What are you doing now?
Well, after the events of this book and kind of a mental health collapse that happened as a result of the Mueller investigation, I set up some guardrails for myself. And those include that I will never work against democracy, I will never work for a dictator, and I won't break the law. These seem like pretty simple rules, but you would be surprised the number of clients this cuts you out from working.
Now, looking back at the whole thing, do you think your days of debate helped you as an operative? You know, thinking on your feet, talking fast, coming up with ideas at the split second.
Yes. The kind of debate I did emphasized the ability to speak quickly. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many words a minute the debaters go at these days, but it was awfully fast. And yes, it taught me how to think quickly, how to creatively solve problems, and think really far outside. People overuse the phrase think outside the box. But I, you know, frankly, for most of my career, there hasn't been a box anywhere in the room. Mm-hmm. It's been all kind of outlandish ideas, the strangest ones that I could find to solve the problem. Some people refer to me as a Rube Goldberg thinker. Meaning, you know, you have to have the ball hit the thing to make the other thing go, and then it starts a fire somewhere. Yeah, that's the nature of my job, is to find creative solutions to problems on behalf of my clients.
And you're still in this business?
Absolutely.
Okay. You know, if you want to learn more about the way in which Phil thinks outside the box, the book, we've only sort of scratched the surface mm-hmm. of the fabulous stories in this book. The book is All the Worst Humans, How I Made News for Dictators, Tycoons, and Politicians. We've been speaking with Phil Elwood. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this. Given today's divided politics, it's kind of hard to believe that in 1984, Ronald Reagan won re-election by carrying 49 states and the District of Columbia. Reagan was a unique political figure with movie star good looks and a warm and witty public persona. But the private Reagan was far more complex. Author Max Boot takes a deep dive into the life and legend of Ronald Reagan in his new biography. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Okay. So Max, what drew you to the topic of Reagan, and how long did it take you to do the research?
It took me about a decade to do the research, and what drew me to the topic was the fact that Reagan was such a consequential president, so important to the world, and to me personally, growing up in the 1980s, but I felt like when I started this project, there really was not a good Reagan biography out there. And so I felt this was a gap that needed to be filled. And that's what I set out to do over the course of the last decade, trying to write something that was truly objective and balanced, presenting both the good and the bad sides of Ronald Reagan, both his strengths as well as his weaknesses. And so I was very gratified to see that the New Yorker, in their review, said that Reagan is life and legend, aims to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So I had kind of a mission accomplished moment there.
Well, it is a really interesting book. I spent a lot of time with it over the weekend. It's interesting that you had access to a lot of people probably near the end of when many of them who had firsthand experience in the Reagan administration are still alive. And in contrast to Edmund Morris's book, Dutch, you didn't have to make things up.
That's true. I kept it rigorously factual when I didn't. I thought that Edmund Morris was a very skilled writer, but he had some kind of weird breakdown while writing the book, his book, and decided to insert himself as a fictional character. So I resisted that temptation. I mean, I think I kind of wrote this book at a sweet spot where we were far enough removed from the Reagan presidency to be able to have some objectivity about it, to be able to see it in historical perspective, and also to have access to a bunch of documents that have since opened up at the Reagan Library and elsewhere. But at the same time, when I started this book, there were still a lot of people in very senior positions in the Reagan administration, and people who knew Reagan very well, who were still very much around. And I was able to interview quite a few of them. And sadly, a number of them are no longer with us, people like Colin Powell or George Shultz, Bud McFarlane, or others. But I was lucky enough to speak to them, and I'm sure in the future there will be other historians who will be have access to even more documents, because new documents open up all the time. But they're not going to be able to talk to the key players, as I was able to do.
Now, can you share a bit about Reagan's youth and how it shaped his political philosophy?
Well, Reagan was really a product of the Midwest. I mean, we think of him as a Westerner because he was governor of California, had a ranch in California, but his personality was really shaped by the small town world of the early 20th century Midwest, and specifically moving around a bunch of small towns in Illinois. His father was an alcoholic shoe salesman who kept losing one job after another, and so the family, you know, had to keep moving. And so Little Dutch Reagan, as he was called, you know, knew that he wasn't going to stay in town long enough to really form any real attachments with the other kids. And that began kind of a lifetime habit of erecting this mental fence around himself and really being fairly aloof and not really having any close friends. I mean, there were, you know, a couple of other influences from childhood. One was the fact that his parents, you know, were often in conflict because his father would go off on these multi-day benders and his mother would not be very happy when he returned. And so Dutch Reagan kind of formed a horror of personality conflict, which is a little bit at odds with his image as being somebody who is very confrontational in his politics. But in his personal approach, whether dealing with his kids or aides or others, he really shied away from any kind of personality conflict or confrontation. And the final influence from his childhood was the fact that, you know, his mother, Nellie, who was a very religious lady, was also kind of a frustrated thespian and, you know, put Little Dutch and his brother Moon on the stage from a very early age when she was staging plays in these churches and other forums in these small Illinois towns. And so Dutch kind of grew up appreciating being applauded and enjoying the sensation of acting. And so that's kind of what his initial impetus for pursuing an acting career, which eventually morphed into his political career. So he was, you know, really profoundly shaped by this Midwestern childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of going beyond that, from the outside, Reagan sort of seemed like the kind of person whose warmth would result in a close family and lots of deep friendships. But that's not the Reagan you portray in the book. He really seemed kind of cold and distant, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he was. And that goes, again, back to his childhood habits of not really getting close to the other kids, never really grew close to most other people, with the exception of Nancy Reagan, throughout his life. And yeah, he would kick it off and be pretty oblivious about what was happening around him, because and what I found was that he kind of used his jokes and stories, and he had, you know, an infinite stockpile of jokes and stories, but he kind of used them to keep the world at kind of a safe remove, and that he always interacted with people at a very superficial level and didn't really delve deep into who they were or what was going on with them. And so that meant, like, for example, you know, his son Michael was, you know, was sexually molested as a youngster, but, you know, President Reagan didn't find this out until Michael wrote a memoir that came out in the 1980s, and he was equally oblivious to a lot of other things that were going on with his kids or later with his aides, so he could be, you know, kind of strangely aloof from those around him. And in fact, as Jim Baker, his White House chief of staff, said to me, you know, you could never forget with Reagan that we were all just, you know, we loved him and admired him, but we were all just hired hands, and, you know, we could be gone tomorrow and he'd never even notice we had been there.
I want to sort of follow up a little bit with the concept of how his initial political views began to shift in Hollywood and as he became a corporate spokesman. Obviously, this is sort of a seminal sort of moment in the trajectory of his thinking. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was really in the 1950s that he became a conservative after having grown up as a New Deal liberal and somebody who worshipped FDR. by the early 1960s, he was a very right-wing Republican. And that transformation, the transformation began in the late 40s when he was a labor leader in Hollywood, president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he became active in the battles over communism in Hollywood and became convinced that there was a communist conspiracy to take over Hollywood, which I think was very exaggerated, but that was certainly his mindset. And then in the 1950s, after his movie career cratered, he became host of General Electric Theater, this show on TV on Sunday nights, and became a spokesman for General Electric. And GE in those days was a very conservative company that really propagandized its employees about the virtues of capitalism and free markets, because they saw that as an inoculation against strikes and union activity. And so Reagan, you know, he would take these long train rides from L.A. to New York because he was afraid of flying in those days. And he would have a lot of time to read on the train, and he would read a lot of this literature that GE was foisting on its employees. And that's what really completed his transformation, not just into an anti-communist, but into a very hardcore doctrinaire conservative who was very much a Republican by the early 60s.
Now, Reagan's approach, you know, moving on to economics, has had major implications that resonate to this day. Can you talk a bit about Reaganomics and the implications with respect to growth, budget deficits, and income inequality, please?
Yeah, I mean, Reagan was very much a believer in lowering taxes, and he achieved that. I mean, he raised some taxes, but he certainly lowered personal income taxes, pretty dramatically, with the top rate falling from like 70% to 30%. Roughly speaking, during his presidency. That had consequences that, you know, he couldn't anticipate. And one of those consequences was that it widened income inequality, because so many of the benefits flowed to the top 1%, and the rest of the country was kind of stagnating or regressing, you know, and that income disparity was widened further by his anti-union activities and by his, failure to enforce antitrust laws. So the result of all of that is, if you look at, you know, income inequality in America, the trend lines really become very divergent in the early 1980s and continue to diverge in subsequent decades. And I think that's kind of had a destabilizing political effect, because it's really fed populism on both the left and the right, whether it was Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party or now Trump, and it's really decreased faith in our political system and our country. And so that those are consequences that Reagan certainly never intended, but that they certainly flow out of some of those free market policies that he pursued.
And the Reagan administration sort of marks a change in what had been a longstanding belief, I believe, on the right, of the importance of balanced budgets. Did Reagan think that he could still, you know, did Reagan understand that he was creating this kind of long-term deficits by his approach to taxation?
He didn't, because he believed, contrary to all evidence, that he could cut income taxes and the result would be an increase in governmental revenues, because he subscribed to this supply-side notion that cutting taxes would stimulate the economy and therefore boost federal revenues. Now, this was not true, and there were no mainstream economists who actually believed this, but Reagan believed it. And so, you know, this is why George H.W. Bush denounced Reaganomics as being voodoo economics, because Reagan imagined that he could cut taxes, raise defense spending, and still balance the budget. And obviously that was impossible, and it proved to be impossible. In fact, the budget deficit skyrocketed on his watch. And when he was asked later on about his presidency, pretty much the only regret that he said that he had was that he couldn't balance the budget. But that was basically, you know, kind of the nature of his economics, that the numbers just did not add up.
Just a moment ago, you mentioned how he was trying to break up some unions, yet as an actor, he was a member of the Screen Actors Guild Union, and which helped him along his career. That was kind of an interesting choice for him to be anti-union, yet it got him going. That, can you speak to any of that, please?
Yeah, I mean, he later said that, you know, it was a breeze for him to negotiate with Soviet leaders, because he had learned negotiating sitting across the table from studio chiefs in Hollywood. And there was no question that being a union leader, that was really his first brush with the political arena. He became a prominent political player in Hollywood and even, you know, testified before the House Un-American Affairs Committee in Washington. And so that was kind of his entry into politics. And he was very proud of the fact that he was the only union leader ever to become president. But in you know, by the time he became president, he very much had this hardline free market anti-union mindset. And of course, one of his first notable actions as president was to break the air traffic controllers union when they went out on strike in the summer of 1981. They thought that because PATCO, their air traffic controllers union, had backed Reagan, that he would cave into their demands, and he didn't, and was willing to fire them and take and, you know, replace them at least temporarily with military air traffic controllers, taking a huge risk, because if there had been an airplane crash at that point, he probably would have been blamed, and it would have been a disaster at both a human and a political level. But things more or less worked out, and he established, you know, his toughness basically by taking on the air traffic controllers union, and that was a message that went out around the world. But of course, the consequence of that was also he set a very anti-union trend in the U.S., which led to a decline in union membership and activism in subsequent decades. And again, I think that helps contribute to this widening income inequality that we've seen in recent decades.
One of the really interesting things about the book is the way you sort of look at the legend, as you say in the title, versus the reality, and sometimes they line up and sometimes they don't. Reagan is often credited with being the key figure in ending the Cold War. Is that fair?
And he was a key figure in ending the Cold War, but not in the way that his admirers often describe it. There's kind of a legend about Ronald Reagan, which is that, you know, he raised defense spending in his first term. He called out the evil empire. He provided support to the Afghan freedom fighters, and all of that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that's not really what happened. I mean, he did do all those things in his first term, but it really produced was war scares with the Soviet Union. It didn't cause the Soviets to buckle under, and they were not going bankrupt. They could still afford their defense spending. The really transformational moment occurred in 1985 when Konstantin Chernenko died and Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. And Gorbachev was really a black swan, somebody who had risen to the top of the communist system while losing faith in that system. And he launched these wide-ranging reforms that, unbeknownst to him, wound up, you know, destroying the Soviet Union. So Reagan didn't cause the Gorbachev reforms and didn't bring down the Soviet Union, but what he did do was he recognized that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist and somebody he could work with, and that was very much contrary to the advice that he was getting from hardliners like his own defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, and others, that Reagan really invested in Gorbachev, wanted to help him and work with him to reduce nuclear weapons and reduce Cold War tensions and ultimately to end the Cold War. And so I think that was the ultimate tribute to his pragmatism. It was really his conciliatory second-term approach to the Soviet Union that paid, you know, major geopolitical dividends, much more so than his confrontational approach during his first term.
Now, you mentioned earlier that when he was sat on the train, he got to read a lot. And one of the things that I found interesting in the book was his portrayal of Reagan as a voracious reader with a phenomenal memory, which is sort of not sort of consistent with his public image during the time. But I want to sort of tie that into Iran-Contra. Can you talk a little bit about Iran-Contra and what does it say about Reagan's ethics and candor?
Well, Iran-Contra was the biggest scandal, not the only scandal, but the biggest scandal of the Reagan administration. And that occurred as a result of Iran taking, or Iranian proxies like Hezbollah, taking Americans hostage in Lebanon. And Reagan, contrary to his image for being kind of this cold-hearted guy, was actually a very soft touch. And he was deeply worried about the fate of the U.S. hostages. And so that led his aides to implement this cockamamie scheme to sell weapons to Iran to get the hostages released. And they did release a few hostages, but then they took some more. So it was a disaster. But then Reagan's national security advisor, John Poindexter, and Ollie North, who was then an aide on the National Security Council, had a further brainstorm to take the profits from the sale of weapons to Iran and funnel it to the Nicaraguan Contras, these anti-communist guerrillas in Nicaragua. And funding them was contrary to a law passed by Congress called the Boland Amendment. So this was a disaster all around and could have led to Reagan's impeachment. But in some ways, Reagan got into the Iran-Contra mess and got out of it for the same reason, which was that he was so disengaged from the management of government. He didn't really know what was, or he claimed not to know what was going on with the diversion of money to the Contras. And, you know, people believed him. I mean, if Richard Nixon had said he didn't know what was going on, everybody would have thought he was lying. But with Reagan, it was actually kind of credible that he didn't realize what his subordinates were up to. So this was kind of the cost the nation paid for a president who was a great leader, but a poor manager.
So I grew up in a place called Geneva, Switzerland, which on the surface is a very staid and boring place. But if you look beneath the surface, it contains all kinds of small jurisdictions, secrets, different systems of law that apply to people depending on their nationality, their wealth, and what they're doing professionally. So I was inspired by this, having left Geneva and going back and rediscovering my hometown. And, you know, you could say that it took me my whole life, but beginning to end, it took me about 4 or 5 years of research and writing to finish the project.
So let's talk about Geneva. You begin the book in Geneva, where you grew up, and I want you to sort of try to explain a little bit about how Geneva and Switzerland are emblematic of this parallel world. How and why did it develop that way in Geneva in particular?
Sure. So a lot of the book talks about the ways that countries, not always big, powerful countries, sometimes small countries with not a lot of resources, leverage their status as a nation to make money. And I begin the story in Switzerland in like the 1200s, because Switzerland was an early pioneer of this business model. What they became famous for worldwide was training and sending mercenaries to help neighboring monarchs win wars. And these people had no skin in the game. They were just, you know, doing a job and coming back. So I draw a connection between this early pioneering mercenary trade and Switzerland's later eagerness to create laws and spaces and regulations to, again, serve neighboring wealthy people, international dictators, all kinds of people who'd want to use Switzerland, which is neutral, by the way, and helps, to preserve their wealth, often outside of their own country's borders.
So let's dig that down a little bit deeper. We're talking about the notion of essentially selling your status as a country. And what does that mean? And for example, you talk a lot about free ports. How are free ports an example of that?
A free port is a piece of land that's cordoned off. It is within a nation's borders, but different rules apply. In the case of industrial free ports, known as special economic zones or export processing zones, these rules can include labor, they can include immigration, and almost all the time, free ports are exempt from various customs and tariff regulations. So something that goes into the free port is not considered an import the same way that it would be considered if you shipped it to a regular Amazon warehouse or your home. So customs duties might not apply. The free port that I talk about in Geneva, that there are also global versions of this, is a warehouse. Not a lot of manufacturing goes on. In fact, there isn't any at all in Geneva. Rather, this is a place where the international ultra-rich go to store their, it's their mini storage. Except instead of having a bunch of junk and, you know, an extra bed frame and what have you, they're there to store their Picassos or their crates of wine or their gold bars or all kinds of expensive things that they might want to preserve for a long time or keep out of the sight of the tax man.
Sounds like a Gabriel Allon, Daniel Silva novel, because it probably, you know, it very much is like that. So let's go through why I would want to do that. I am a super wealthy guy, I wish, and I have purchased a Picasso or a nice piece of artwork. Why do I want to stash it in this Freeport? What is that keeping me from having to do?
So there are several reasons you'd do that, and it depends on which Freeport you choose, because each one is a special snowflake, has its own particularities and perks. But broadly speaking, one reason would be secrecy. Maybe you are going through a divorce, and you don't want to declare all of your assets to your ex. That's a great place to do that. Another reason could be taxes. Depending on where you are and who you are, your purchase, or if you resell this piece of art, could incur a sales tax, for example. But if you do it within the four walls of the Freeport, you're maybe going to get around that, right? Depending if you play your cards right. There's a really banal reason, which is that many of these Freeports are just tricked out, super safe, climate controlled, you name it. And so your Picasso is going to enjoy a long life behind these walls. But the flip side is that nobody's going to look at it, right? Yeah. And what is art if not for us to admire?
Now, how is Switzerland making money through this? Because obviously there's a motivation. Countries do this for a reason that's probably not all that, you know, altruistic.
So Switzerland has developed a reputation for this sort of thing over a long time. And so it's already a go-to place for investment, for, you know, private money, wealth management. But if a smaller upstart, if another country might decide to go this route, right, figure out a way to use its sovereignty to make money, it could go any number of ways. This can take the form of a country creating special postage stamps that stamp collectors will buy for a lot of money. Just because this is something that countries can do that normal people can't just create a postage stamp, right? This is why you end up with a Burkina Faso putting Elvis Presley on a postage stamp. It's just an easy way to make money. Countries might pass laws accommodating cryptocurrency industries or sell flags for ships that allow the ship owners to get around various environmental protections or labor laws. There is a thriving market for flags for shipping that sometimes it's even landlocked countries that are renting out their sovereignty, their flag, to ships to use on the high seas, because that's how the high seas are governed on vessels. So the possibilities are endless. If you're an enterprising nation that wants to get in on this, really the sky's the limit. Or even further, you know, you could even pass laws for outer space. And I have a chapter in the book that talks about how Luxembourg did just that.
You do, and we were gonna, you took us right to one of the next ports we were going to sail into, which is talking about Luxembourg and space. What are they doing, and how are they making money?
So this is one of my favorite things to talk about the book. Luxembourg is a close cousin of Switzerland, right? They have a history of accommodating private wealth from abroad. It's likewise a small country that had a steel industry, but that sort of collapsed at the beginning of the century, and they had to find new ways to stay afloat. So some of that was creating incentives for companies to come and, you know, pay less in value-added tax, for example, in Europe. They created a structure that allowed foreign account holders to kind of shield their wealth through these trusts. And that created a lot of bad press, right? Luxembourg was kind of seen as a little sketchy for a time, especially among its European peers. So it totally changed the conversation and decided to pass a law that recognizes private property in outer space. This is interesting because outer space is governed by no nation, right? There are treaties governing outer space that were signed at the UN, but when these treaties were signed, they did not really stipulate what happens to wealth in space. So if you're an asteroid miner, you go to an asteroid, you drill down, you find some gold. This is hypothetical, but not entirely, right? Yeah. This could happen. You need a country to recognize that that wealth belongs to you, and then to allow you to sell it and to transact with it and turn it into something of value, right? Because if it's floating around out there and no one recognizes that it is even property, like, what's the point? So Luxembourg moved to pass a law, the most broad-ranging of all space laws, to recognize these sorts of things for anybody who has a company in Luxembourg. What does that do? Well, it brings a lot of space companies to Luxembourg. Luxembourg was also offering funding and other programs to actually develop this into an industry, right? So it's not just mailboxes for Elon Musk and his buddies. But it was really successful. I mean, this program was a hit. They have, you know, space conferences all the time. And they're even talking about, you know, creating a bit more of a space program to actually go out to outer space. But for now, this is mostly a commercial enterprise.
Gotcha. And now what about satellite paths?
Yeah, this didn't come out of nowhere. Luxembourg was also a pioneer in privatizing the airwaves in Europe when radio was entirely public. And then sort of graduated to getting into the satellite industry. And it because it was willing to privatize communications, it built up its satellite industry as a sort of precursor to this Space Resources Act.
Can you tell us a little bit about what charter cities are?
Charter cities are very controversial. So the origin of the term charter city comes from an economist named Paul Romer. He's a very well-known, brilliant economist who won the Nobel Prize. And in the early 2000s, Paul Romer had been working on the effect of importing ideas into economies and the effect that ideas have in economic growth. And it occurred to him that laws were not unlike ideas in that they weren't finite. You can share them, you can bring them to other countries. And so if you are a country that is suffering from a lack of good laws, so if you don't have the laws that businesses trust and want to work with, you're in trouble because you're not going to attract industry to your nation. So Romer floated this idea, and I'm super oversimplifying. What if we borrowed laws from a country like Canada and plopped them down in a state like Madagascar and encouraged industry and business to operate using this incentive, right? Thinking there's nothing that keeps a law stuck in one place. There's nothing that keeps Canadian law stuck in Canada. So why don't we spread the wealth in that sense? This is a way of thinking about economics and law that assumes that a good law will create, you know, more industry and more economic growth. But it also sounds a bit like colonialism, right? Like taking another country's law and like sending it to a less developed state, and you know, it's not a great look. And so there was a big backlash to this concept of a charter city, the charter city being the poorer country that's borrowing the laws. This has evolved over time. So Paul Romer is no longer part of this conversation. He's distanced himself from it. These days, if you say charter city, the associations are more with a sort of libertarian corporatist philosophy, which is that, you know, this country might have crummy laws. Let's bring in a corporation to run the show instead.
How many charter cities would you say there are around the world that you know of?
Well, there's one in Honduras that is likewise extremely controversial. In fact, it's in the middle of some pretty big time international litigation. To make a long story short, the Honduran Supreme Court passed a law allowing for these very, very devolved autonomous zones that are essentially controlled by a board appointed by a private company. There was one that was built on the island of Roatan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they broke ground, they made some buildings, they had some events there. But a new government came in 2022, and they've been very against this project. So these investors that are mostly American are suing the state of Honduras for, you know, depriving them of future profits. It's an absurd sum. It's more than $10 billion. Honduras is not a wealthy nation. So unclear what's going to happen with this, but there are some very passionate people on both sides.
But touching on a concept where I take a city in a third world country, for example, and say I'm going to import laws from another jurisdiction, there's a related concept that I thought was really interesting where you talk about Mark Beer and the concept, the legal innovations associated with the Dubai International Financial Center. Let's talk about what that is and what Beer did.
Yeah, so Dubai is a city in the United Arab Emirates. It's referred to as a city-state because it governs a lot of its own affairs. And for years and years, Dubai had its legal system that was just the Dubai legal system. As part of its economic development program, Dubai made a point of carving out free zones, like the ones we talked about before, with rules that are sort of custom made to attract certain types of business. So there's a commodities zone, there's a media zone, there's a finance zone. And in the finance zone, the people, the architects of the zone, both the physical architects and the sort of legal architects, realized that to get the big banks and trading desks and, you know, other financial institutions, they were going to have to create a court where these people felt comfortable taking their case. This is partly because the Dubai courts are in Arabic. They were based on civil law and Islamic law, not really legal systems that, you know, an accountant trained in London or in the US is going to be familiar with. Right, so that was the pitch. We're going to create a legal system that your people are going to just be able to drop in and function in. And they did that. So Dubai has three courts, and then they just added on this court in a free zone on top of it all to sort of supplement. Now, the cases themselves, you know, there's nothing super dramatic going on there. It's normal contractual disputes and workplace stuff. But what it does do is it creates a parallel legal system for businesses and mostly foreign businesses. There's no limit on who, you know, who can buy in, who can opt into this court system, but it is distinct from the Emirati one. And it's a very unusual way of doing things, but I think that it's catching on in other free zones around the world. The architect of the DIFC courts, or the, I guess the big promoter of it, is a man named Mark Beer. He's a British lawyer. He took this idea to Kazakhstan, which has gotten behind it. So I expect to see a lot more of these in the future.
And what was interesting to me, and maybe I didn't understand it, but as I was reading it, was this notion that it's almost like a private arbitration service, in the sense that parties who really don't have a lot to do with Dubai can opt into using this court to get binding rulings. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, binding to a point. They've made deals with a bunch of other jurisdictions to enforce the judgments. I don't think it's everywhere, but if you and I got into some business dispute, before we got into the dispute, we could choose to have our case heard at the DIFC court, and we have nothing to do with this place at all.
Right. And you also had an interesting section where you talked about the notion that litigation about the DIFC itself, there's been some controversy about where that would be litigated, whether that would be litigated in the UAE courts as opposed to the DIFC. I was a little confused by it, but I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, they had a curious case involving the construction of one of the structures in the DIFC. It's called the gate. It's this big gate. You know, it looks like a bunch of gray Legos. And this gate was kind of falling apart, and it, you know, some plastic, I think some bricks fell down and could have hurt somebody. And the question was, this is entirely within the physical jurisdiction of the DIFC, right? Shouldn't this case be heard in the DIFC court? And there was some back and forth about whether this would be the case, because there was a party saying, well, it should go to the Dubai court. So nothing that you can't take anything for granted is the upside.
You talked about the concept of state-free zones and how it's applied to issues of migration in places like Haiti and Australia.
Yeah, something I really wanted a point that I really wanted to make is that the flip side of sending wealth offshore to places where it was protected and you know, maybe one tax authority can't get into its business, the secrecy and the sort of protection that wealth enjoys offshore, the flip side of that is that these offshore structures and offshore places are also used to send people away. So in the 1990s, when there were large numbers of Haitian citizens leaving Haiti because of instability, many of these people wound up on Guantanamo Bay. This is before Gitmo was, a site for the war on terror. This was a migrant detention camp. And it was useful for the U.S. because they could argue.